This is XTP Media.
I think that you see this, the legacy of the 707 in every aspect of life. I mean, whether it's the incredibly diverse multicultural communities that we all live in. Most 727s were rolled. Prototype 747 was barrel rolled. They've even got footage of a 767 doing a complete barrel roll.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Ready for takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 94 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by author Charles Kennedy to talk about the Boeing 707. Charles, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Very excited about talking about your book. That is, of course, the Haynes Manual on the Boeing 707, 1957 to present. A little confession before everybody jumps on me. It's the first aircraft I ever flew on, so I'm very passionate about the 707, and I love
and I'm jealous.
I loved the book, so I got it as a present and read it from start to finish, it almost in one read. So I'm really excited to have you on the program with us. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, Charles, let's start then, because I know you've written some other books on some classics. Maybe we can pick up either later or another time. But how did you get into writing about airliners and aviation?
Well, it's been my hobby and my passion since I was a kid. I mean, when I was a little kid, I was into bus timetables and ships and things. But I was pretty young when it settled on airliners and civil aviation. Fast forward, to the present, I started writing articles for Airliner World and Aviation News. I literally just, I was a reader, and then I thought I'd see if they wanted to let me write for them, because I was doing some quite interesting trips chasing DC-10s around Bangladesh and Aleutian 18s in Somalia, and those trips formed the basis of my first articles. And then the writing of books started because me and my buddy wanted to crowdfund the rescue of a Flying Tigers DC-8 simulator, and what was supposed to be just a little, like a pamphlet really, with just a fleet list and a few pictures for people who contributed to rescuing the DC-8 simulator, turned into a pretty hefty coffee table book about Flying Tigers DC-8s, and that was where my book writing started.
Wow. And you mentioned a few there. I know you've covered 747 and some old school Soviet stuff as well. So very excited to to talk about those sometime.
Sure.
But let's get on to the 707. And a classic, if there ever was one.
Absolutely.
Let's start off with development. Where did the 707 come from? How did it come about?
Well, it's what I think is known as the peace dividend that followed the end of World War II. All those young engineers and scientists who were inventing bouncing bombs and radar and Manhattan Project were then off the leash to go and invent the future. And I think especially in the United States, because they survived the war, obviously, with their industrial infrastructure in place, unscathed. So it was, sticking fins on cars and home appliances. Of course, the vinyl records launched by CBS Laboratories on the longest day of 1948 for the long player. And with Boeing, creating the B-47 and the B-52, Pratt & Whitney, obviously, with some great early jet engines, it wasn't going to take long before that technology was applied to civilian air transport, and the 707 came out of that. And I think also the US military needed a tanker and a transport, especially a tanker. Actually, they were using Stratocruisers as to refuel in flight their B-47s, and so you've got a B-47 that's hanging on the edge of a stall with all the flaps out, and the fueling aircraft, the Stratocruiser, running at full tilt, and so the speeds weren't compatible. So I think that drove it as well. So there was actually a military incentive as well to create a tanker and a transport that would be compatible with the bomber fleet of SAC.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Stratocruiser there, and one of the things that grabs me from the book, actually, it only sort of dawned on me, is the 707 is a very classical looking aircraft, but you can actually see the shape and the style coming through those older Boeing aircraft, and there's a real heritage there that filters through the design of the 707, isn't there?
It's true. Well, I mean, even in cross section, I mean, the 707 does have a very gentle double bubble cross section, like the Stratocruiser, less pronounced, but it's there. And I have wondered. I mean, I wish I knew, but I just wonder how many parts on a 707 were actually used B-17s and things. I remember sitting in a B-17 at the US Air Force and Europe Museum in Duxford and thinking, how many of these parts survived into the 707? I mean, in the sense that the knob on the end of the handle that opens and closes the cockpit windows on the DC-9 is the same knob that is on the throttle levers of a DC-3.
Wow. So exactly,
it grandfathered in. And so there must be, I mean, as you say, some elements you can see, and there must be other elements that are less visible but are present.
Yeah. And the development of the aircraft led to what became known as the Dash 80. Into the test program. It wasn't the easiest of test programs for the aircraft, though, was it?
No, but I mean, it could have gone worse than it did. I mean, there was, I think it was a very, very good design. I mean, what the defining element of the 707 is how much Boeing got right. I mean, you could get a guy who was test flying Dash 8s in the 50s and stick him in a Ryanair 737-800, and I think he'd pretty much be able to operate the overhead panel without looking.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's to say that the modern 737 is particularly outdated in that sense. I just think that as much as anything, it's how right Boeing got it. So, I mean, yeah, there were issues. I mean, they had issues with flutter. They had persistent issues with brakes and wheel brake fires, including in flight. Nothing catastrophic, you know. I mean, they could have bailed out if they had to. They took parachutes with them, and there was an escape chute, but obviously never needed.
Yeah, and we couldn't leave the test program without talking about Tex Johnson.
I know what you're
going
to say. Yes.
And the famous barrel rolls. And there's some great stories in the book about that, and I won't steal any thunder on that. But the thing that grabbed me, and I had no idea this has happened, but I was really surprised to read that most of the test aircraft were rolled. Most of the 707s, as they came off the line, barrel rolled.
Yes, really a lot of them. I mean, because I think Tex Johnson, he was so famous. I mean, and I would say not just among pilots, but in the general public. So when you've got guys who were coming onto it's their first jet, and it's so exciting. I think that, that they obviously wanted to imitate it. And as Tex always said, it was pretty much a 1G maneuver. But yeah, so pretty much every 707 was rolled on delivery flights, test flights, training flights. Again, I mean, there's more about this in the book, but tragically, Lufthansa lost an aircraft on a training flight doing a barrel roll. And I think that was when it came out, how prevalent it was. And so after that, it was a lot more, it had to be kept under wraps, because officially it was forbidden, but I think people kept doing it. And not only that, but there's a really, really good book, which I recommend to you and your listeners, which is called Growing Up Boeing. And it's by the daughter of one of Boeing's top test pilots. And in that book, it says that most 727s were rolled. The prototype 747 was barrel rolled. They've even got footage of a 767 doing a complete barrel roll, filmed from the camera ship. I know, it's unbelievable to think about. Yeah. Concorde was barrel rolled. There's a great clip on YouTube of I can't remember the guy. It's not Trubshaw. It's another one of the really famous Concorde pilots talking about how he went up with a French test pilot and they went and did a barrel roll. And then it's like, okay, well, you have to undo it. So they did another one. Yeah.
Wow. I never knew that. But it was a test to the design and the quality of the build, because we have to remember, you know, there weren't any computer-controlled manufacturing elements. It was all hand built, was hand designed, and it was
completely.
It's quite an amazing aircraft for to have come out of the post-war era, but it wasn't the only one, and it was competing with several others. You mentioned the DC-8. Of course, we had the Convair pairs. We got the VC-10, and you know, even the Soviets had the Ilyushin 62. There were a lot of four-holers coming on into the market then. How did the 707 single itself out to such success?
I think it's first mover advantage, really. I mean, and by first mover, we're only talking about it only beat the DC-8 into service by 1 or maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
But you know, I think we're not talking about the diff. I mean, there's been times since where there's been an evolution, even a big step up. Perhaps the introduction of wide body jets would be considered to be a big step, or fly-by-wire, perhaps, wide-body twins over water, etc. But none of those changed for the fundamental passenger experience remotely like going from a piston prop liner to a jet. And so I think that just by beating the DC-8 by 18 months was enough to get everyone in line for the 707. The DC-8 sold half as many ships, and with a dizzying number of variations to tempt customers to buy DC-8s. And I think it was just that small advantage was all it took.
Yeah, and the DC-8, just visually seemed very much slimmer. Was there anything in the cabin layouts that differentiated them? Because the 707 slightly larger.
I would say only within about an inch or two difference as far as the internal dimensions go.
Yeah.
Both Douglas and Boeing struggled against airline pressure to create a 6 abreast cabin. Boeing especially wanted to do 5, which was and they wouldn't budge on that. And then it was actually Juan Trip, the boss of Pan Am, who launched an order for 25 707s and 20 DC-8s on the same day, which shocked Boeing into adopting the 6 abreast configuration. So no, I think when the dust settled, they were pretty much the same. I mean, I think the DC-8 looks a little bit different. I think it hints at different proportions because the window spacing is very different.
Right.
But I think it's a trick of the eye.
Okay, gosh, I never knew that. Or back in the day in the '70s when I was spotting, I always thought the DC-8 was slimmer. But there you go.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Before we talk about some of the different models of the 707, just want to get your view, particularly being a Brit, and talking about the 707 coming into service. Obviously, there was the rivalry with the de Havilland Comet at the time. How do you think Boeing handled that? I mean, ultimately came out on top for reasons we all know. But how did they handle it at the time?
I mean, it's not very complimentary to their perception of the British industry, but I don't think that they really felt that the British industry was a serious competitor. I think that, you know, they were impressed by the I mean, the Comet 1 was in service in May 1952. It's unbelievable. Yeah. But I mean, it's such a small airplane, and I think, you know, with very primitive passenger accommodation and I don't think they saw it as much of a rival. No, I mean, it is nice. I think it's thrilling that even when the Comet 4 went into service, it was able to beat the 7.0 by at least 3 weeks. BOEC opened transatlantic service in both directions on the 4th of October 1958. And Pan Am didn't start 707 service until the 26th of the same month. So it's 20 BOEC. They won the battle by 22 days with the Comet 4. But I think, you know, Boeing recognized, and probably rightly, the limitations of the British industry, especially given, you know, what we've been through in World War II. And I think there was one Boeing guy who came over to see de Havilland and reported back. He said, I believe the words were, he said, it's like a flying club, which it would have been. Because you can't compare. I mean, the massive, I don't know. I mean, where do you start? I mean, the facilities that Boeing had. I mean, how many B-17s and B-29s did they build? I mean, it's thousands and thousands and thousands, and all of to have all of that intact. So they were ready to just go straight into production and build hundreds of planes. Whereas I'm not sure if the Comet got into triple figures. The VC-1054 built.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a different animal completely.
Yeah, it went on to be the great success that we all know. But let's talk about then some of the variants of the 707. We'll come back to maybe some of the military models, because as you mentioned earlier on, that was a strong part of the development of the program.
But absolutely.
Let's talk about some of the civilian models. I mean, I recognize the three Continent, the 300 Continentals, of course, but we've got the 720 in there that always seemed an unusual size. Can you just talk us through the variants?
For sure. The Dash 80, it is better thought of as a prototype for the C-135 and KC-135, which was the military variant. The C-135 was a transport. The KC-135 was a tanker. And by the way, they were narrower. The Dash 80 and the 135s had a narrower fuselage, more like the size of a DC-9 or a Fokker F-100.
Okay.
If it had seating, it would have seated a five abreast, not six. And then the first 707 was the series 100 or the 120. Very low bypass turbojets, incredibly noisy, but quite anemic. I mean, American Airlines could barely fly them on their domestic trips across the country. They had to stop in Phoenix for fuel on westbound trips.
Yeah.
Pan Am couldn't do transatlantic nonstop. They stopped in Gander on their trips east, and in Keflavik on the return leg back to the United States. So really not even not an intercontinental. And then came the intercontinental, which was a bigger plane, bigger wing, more fuel, and that had the still turbojet, but the bigger and more powerful JT4A engine from Pratt & Whitney. Yeah. Then came the turbofan. So once they stretched the airplane from the series 100s up to the 300s, the fuselage didn't change size. They didn't stretch it again. But the 300 or the 320, if you prefer, was a turbojet powered. The 320B and C were turbofan powered, and of course the 420 was powered by Rolls-Royce Conway engines.
Yeah,
which were fat. That was a turbofan, albeit a vanishingly low bypass ratio.
And how did that come about then, Charles? That there were the varying models with different power plants.
Well, I think they were pushing it at the edge of what was possible. As soon as the JT4, the bigger turbojet, came along, that was an opportunity, like I say, to stretch the fuselage and give it the bigger wing. The big wing also was a big reason for putting the bigger wing on it, was to give it more fuel capacity, as well as the lift and aeronautical refinements. It also meant more room for fuel. And then when the turbofan came along, obviously it was quieter. It was quite a bit more efficient. Even the early ones, quite a bit more efficient. And never looked back. The Rolls-Royce, of course, was the Rolls-Royce Conway was actually the first ever turbofan jet engine ever. It actually beat the Pratt & Whitney JT3D turbofan into service. So there was a desire to use turbofans as soon as possible, but also, of course, an urge on, especially on the part of the British carriers and Commonwealth carriers, although not all, to use a Rolls-Royce engine. I think, you know, they're probably a bit sad that the Americans had taken the lead, but by using Rolls-Royce engines, there was still a way for BOAC and Cunard and Air India, etc., to use a British American hybrid. Yeah. And BOAC especially, with their first 707s, which were all Rolls Royce powered, it wasn't a Boeing 707; it was a Rolls Royce 707.
Very good.
It was quite charming. Yeah.
And of course, later models had the CFM 56. I mean, it's funny just mentioning these power plants, JT4, JT3, the Conway, the CFM. They're almost classics in their own right as well, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yes. Very, very good point. Absolutely. Especially those old Pratt and Whitneys.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. 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 I have a colleague who used to work for Pratt & Whitney, and he could wax lyrical about those engines for a very long time.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
Well, let's come back to the types. I just want to come back to the 720, which always seemed to me, from a novice's perspective, to be the odd one out. But it was there for a very specific reason, wasn't it?
That's right. We were pushing so hard at the edge of what was possible, and even though a true short and medium haul jet airliner, to be clear, was only a couple of years away. I mean, the 727 first flew in January 1963. I mean, that's pretty early. I mean, JFK was in the White House. I mean, it's early stuff. But even that was, even without on the drawing board, it was too far away for the smaller, medium-sized communities that really wanted jet service. The 707 was great for London to Paris, New York to Paris, or Los Angeles to Miami, you know, long trips between big cities. But Milwaukee and Denver and Tucson, and, you know, for that matter, on this side of the Atlantic, similar smaller communities were just crying out for jet service. And so it was quicker for Boeing to shrink the 707. It has the same cross section, but it's shorter. The structure is lighter. Even the main landing gear wheels are a little bit smaller.
Okay.
Although I think it has at least 80% commonality with its bigger brother.
Yeah.
And the 720 was intended for those shorter trips. And a few little aerodynamic enhancements, the leading edge of the wing especially, to give it a lower landing speed to get in and out of short fields. 1 mile, really, a mile of tarmac was fine for a 720. Wow. And they built 154 of them, I mean, which is quite an impressive number. And in service into the 90s, even with carriers like Air Malta, yep, PIA, MEA of Lebanon, kept their 720s right up to pretty much to when noise regulations precluded their continuing use.
Yeah.
So I find that absolutely thrilling that even this sort of interim jet not sold in good numbers and stayed in service right up to the end of their design lives.
I always thought there were a lot more of them made than that. Maybe it was just the frequency of seeing them, but I always thought there were more. I was lucky enough to be in and around London, Gatwick and Heathrow to see them coming in. So maybe I always assumed there'd be a lot more than that.
The 720, I mean, they tended to have quite colourful second lives. And especially in Europe, actually, especially with leisure carriers. I mean, Monarch was a very prolific operator of 720s. There was a bunch of them in Scandinavia with Conair and a few of those. There's a couple of other names that escaped me from north of the Arctic Circle. So we did see a lot of them here in even in the 80s, in fact.
You mentioned a few there, but it was the mainstream operators that that really brought the volume into play. And we've mentioned Pan Am and British British Airways. I should slap my wrist. BOAC time.
BA didn't retire their last 707 until 1984. So
yeah.
You can claim that one for sure.
As I said, it was my first. It was a BA 707. But let's talk about where it served around the world. What sort of numbers were built, and who were the sorts of airlines that operated it?
Well, I mean, everyone operated it. I mean, I think that then CAAC, now Air China, in the 70s, a communist airline, got the 707, loved the 707, actually. And everyone else that you can think of. I mean, it's easier to name the airlines that didn't. I suppose airlines that had a strong relationship with Douglas held out for the DC-8, carriers like Scandinavian Airlines, who are a very prolific Douglas operator, springs to mind. But pretty much everyone else, and even most of the prolific Douglas operators, fell in line. I mean, they built over 1,000, including the military variants. 1,010 were built.
Mm.
If you line them up nose to tail, they run from Heathrow Airport deep into the East End.
Wow.
And if you combine all the distance flown by 707s, you're talking about, over 60,000 return trips to the moon.
Wow.
Which is pretty much the only place they never flew to.
Yeah, they do, and they could be found anywhere and everywhere. And I suppose the great thing about the 707 is it got a new life, didn't it? They became, as you mentioned there on 720, they went into the leisure industry, but a lot of them found their way into cargo operations.
Absolutely, yeah. And I always say, and at the end of their lives, not at the beginning, it shows how not only how versatile, but how durable these ships were, because, coming up to retirement, when they should have been probably enjoying quite an easy life, they were flying in some really dicey places, with some fairly unforgiving environments, some were in Africa were owned by the captain. I mean, owner operator. Because remember, we're talking about the 1980s, really. Before the end of the Cold War, all those Russian Ilyushin 76s weren't on the scene yet. I mean, the 76 was in service in the Soviet Union, but they were sort of just in that just in that part of the world, whereas in the 90s all those Illusion 76s became available globally, you know. Yeah. But so in the 80s, yeah, I mean, you had some very, very dicey cargo operators, as I like to say, putting the fly in fly-by-night operation. Down, I have to say, including, you know, owned by the captain, and you're just going to fly it wherever and whenever.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, managing editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. The guys at Extended have once again kindly given me a few minutes to talk about our latest edition, TAH-28, officially published on July the 15th. The new issues arrived from the printers a few days ago, and I immediately posted a picture on our Facebook page. The issue has a particularly compelling cover photograph, a dynamic head-on view by Peter Lewis of a Swiss Dassault Mirage 3RS Amir, the photo recce variant, snaking through a vertiginous mountain valley. The snow-speckled background is nicely blurred, and the aircraft is pin-sharp, the sense of high-speed motion enhanced by the snaking wingtip vortices and the hot shimmer of the jet flux. Oh, it's a delight. The Facebook post attracted comments ranging from, "That's a bit of a photo, is that?" to, "Oh, baby," with 3 exclamation marks. And it's not just Peter Lewis's flying photographs that make our cover story special. The Mirages were housed in a cavernous hangar tunnel carved into a mountainside, where a roof-mounted hoist system was used to pick them up from their parking bays, carry them over the top of their stablemates, and deposit them at the hangar mouth. We had to get special permission to include a very rare photo of that. Anyone excited by our cover story is likely to be equally excited by the rest of the issue. We explore the aeromedical aspects of piloting the Luftwaffe's Bachem-Natta rocket interceptor, not an article for the squeamish, Howard Hughes's special fondness for the Lockheed Constellation, World War II attempts to turn the Douglas DC-4E airliner and the C-54 transport into bombers, RAF heavy guns, and the political genesis of the Airbus programme, which nearly fell victim to what author Professor Keith Hayward calls a proto-Brexit. Oh, I said the B word again. That's another 50p in the tin. Finally, we publish a bizarre sequence of photographs showing a fairy barracuda being pushed over a cliff on the Welsh coast sometime in the mid-1940s to smash onto the rocks below. It's like the full-size equivalent of a schoolboy setting fire to an Airfix model. Why and exactly where did it happen? We investigate. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking to Extended.
Now, we couldn't leave the book without the story of 5NMAS.
Yeah.
It's a long story, but it's worth telling. If nothing else, people have to buy the book for this.
Well, sure. No, I mean, I'd
never heard of it.
No, well, I think it's a really good example of the kind of thing that was, you know, going on with some of these operators, a lack of maintenance and a lack of oversight, flag of convenience registrations, and when some of those went badly wrong, especially if there was no life lost, it doesn't really make news, you know, because it's you know, an accident in a far-flung place where there's probably no photographic evidence of what happened, and again, no, you know, there's no big death toll to grab headlines. So a lot of the kind of these kind of funny accidents never, you know, they're just a statistic, you know, about, you know, a hull loss, blah blah blah. But no, 5NMAS, I mean, it was a 707 flight from Luxembourg to, I think it was going to Kano in Nigeria. And they lost number 3 engine pylon failed, and the number 3 engine, as it departed the airframe at 29,000 feet over France, hit number 4 engine, and so they lost both engines off one wing, not only lost power but but actually missing from the airframe. And the airplane went out of control in a horrendous dive. They were able to somewhat salvage control. They were kind of heading for Marseille, but there was thunderstorms in the way. They weren't sure if they could keep it airborne that long anyway. The FO knew the area, and also I think he actually spotted a little bit of the runway and I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's Istres or Istra. It's I'll spell it. I S T R E S.
Yeah.
Some of the Air France Concordes used it as a test airfield before the return to flight in 2001. But yeah, very long runway, at least 2 miles of runway, and they were able to get to land there. But I mean, in a state that was every bit as dramatic as a bomber returning from a mission, full of holes. I mean, in actual fact, one of the standout moments for me in the story is that they nominated Istres. They've got a frequency. They call the guy up and say, Mayday, etc. And we're coming in. And the controller says, "Oh, we can see you." And the flight replies, "How? Because we're in cloud." And the controller says, "We can see you because you're on fire." I mean, the whole cloud was lit up. And this,
I shouldn't laugh. It's just
but it is comical. I mean, it's so horrendous. It's so frightening. I mean, the FO took a picture, and heartbreakingly, I couldn't get it cleared in time for the publishing of the book. Although there is a photo out there. I remember it was in Flight International, actually, of the wing in flight with no engines, and he took the picture in the hope that they would find his camera in the wreckage. I mean, it was that bad. But they were able to land at a tire melting speed down with a tailwind landing, no flaps. I mean, they need a lot of power to keep it going in a straight line. They touched down at something like 220 knots. But even the cargo was saved.
As I said, I did read the book almost in one reading, and when I got to that, I was absolutely gripped. I'd never heard the story, and as I say, for anyone who's listening, who's interested, by the manual just for that. But it did go on serving after that. I think the last remaining models in civilian service were in Iran, Sahar Air.
Correct. Sahar Air. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Because of the sanctions, mostly US sanctions against Iran, they and really to this day, they haven't been able to buy new airplanes really since the 70s, since the end of the 70s. So those 707s. It's an odd conversion because most tankers start out as airliners and become like the Royal Air Force TriStars. Yeah. They were Pan Am and British Airways TriStars and they became tankers. Well, those Iranian 707s were delivered as tankers in the 70s, and later, especially after the conclusion of the Iran-Iraq War, and Iran had a booming population and a booming economy in the 90s. Needed all the capacity they could get domestically, so those tankers were converted into passenger airliners and flew right up until about April 2013 they were retired. Wow. From passenger service, and then kept doing cargo flying within Iran and in the region until a tragic accident just it was either the end of last year or the beginning of this year. They had an overrun in landing in they landed at the wrong airfield in Iran, and it was much shorter than the destination runway, which was in line with the same runway heading, but just a few miles further on. And they went off the end at high speed, and with the loss of the aircraft and crew. I've flown on that airplane now many times on my trips to Iran when I was going there to fly on these old birds. Today, Iran fills that capacity gap with a huge armada of second-hand, third-hand, fourth-hand MD-80s that they mostly get through Ukraine. But recently as 2013, it was, wall-to-wall 707, 727, and lots of Tupolev 154s as well.
Wow, okay. I remember them visiting the UK, but that was Iran Air, I think, before the Troubles.
Yeah.
So let's talk then about some of the military models, and I was going to use the term that spun off from the civilian model, but as we mentioned earlier, were part of the driving force behind the airframe in the first place.
True, true. Certainly, yeah. With the 135 was a military variant that was intended from the beginning. But then once the true 707 came along, then yeah, there was plenty of military applications and some very interesting and cranky ones. I mean, obviously the E3 Sentry. I think I'm not as fluent on the military stuff.
Okay.
But the
KC-135 was the engine room, should we say, behind a lot of those models.
Yes, exactly.
And still is very much in operation today, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, as you say, they've been re-engined with the CFM56, and I mean, they're talking about some of them flying until 2050. I mean, they're talking about, but you're talking about 100-year service life.
Yeah, yeah. It's amazing, and I'm sure carrying all that fuel is pretty heavy, so the stresses and strains on the airframe just go to prove how well it was built. And
absolutely.
In the book, you've got great cutaways, and also I don't think it's layman's description of the structure and the various systems in it, but it's quite a comprehensive discussion about a write-up of the systems. How did it compare with, we've mentioned some of those competitors, DC-8s, Convairs, VC-10s and that. How did it compare in terms of the technology in those early days and through to its current models?
Well, I think it was pretty sophisticated. I mean, Boeing had such a good running start with the B-47 and the B-52. It wasn't such a big leap for them. I mean, they were already in the business of building big jet powered, swept wing, platforms. So I think that was what helped to make the systems quite sophisticated, probably incredibly sophisticated for the time, but not overcomplicated. I mean, Lockheed, I think, really shot themselves in the foot with the TriStar by making it very, very complex. And indeed, the Convair 880 and 990 were somewhat complex. Needlessly so. Mm. The fuel system on the Convair jets was particularly, over complex, with a lot of extra sort of auxiliary tanks and venting systems and things. So no, I just think the 70 was a perfect mix of it was sophisticated, but it wasn't overcomplicated.
And maintenance wise, it was, how was it like for the maintenance teams?
I think great. I mean, I'm sure there was, teething problems. I mean, there was just in the early 707s, I think there was teething problems because some of the early systems were replaced. There was a cooling system. I don't remember the details, but it was like they went from Freon cooling to a different system. And like the first 50 ships had one system and then everything else had the other because whatever, they realized this isn't quite adequate, etc. And so some of those early ships struggled because once they stopped putting those systems in airplanes on the line in Seattle, then it became much harder to get parts. Some of those early ships, I think, probably struggled a little bit with parts availability, because they were discontinued systems in the planes. But no other than that, I mean, I've only ever heard good things really about the 70 in terms of its maintenance career. One thing I should say, just on the subject of the book itself, is that Haynes is a famous brand for decades. I mean, everyone's dad had a Haynes for the family car. And it's more recently, of course, very recently, they've sort of leveraged the brand by, taking the format and the template but applying it to things where an owner won't necessarily refer, certainly in the case of the Death Star or the zombie apocalypse, which they've done construction maps for. The first one they did that was sort of off piece was the Spitfire. That was where it started. So okay. It's a bit, but I really wanted to be faithful to the to the spirit of a Haynes manual. So I felt it was appropriate to be reasonably techie. You know, it's not, you know, some books about historical planes or any sort of historical subject, you know, can be more sort of artistic and more led by photos or colorful prose. But, and of course, I wanted to get those in there too. But it was important for me to be faithful to the Haynes template.
No, it's great. There are great photos in here, some unique ones. Not seen many of them before. There's the odd one in there that I've seen before, but again, it's a great cocktail of photography in there that spans the generations.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
One of the things, and I suppose taking the Haynes manual concept to its ultimate, that you do cover is flying the aircraft as well.
Yeah.
And whilst I take it you're not a qualified 707 pilot,
No.
What did you learn from the research and the interviews you did on that?
It's a good question. What did I learn from it? Well, what did I learn that I didn't know already? Because I've probably got about 10 or 15 hours of instruction on the 707 at the Pan Am Flight Academy in Miami, which is where the world's last active 707 simulator is. Yeah. And it won't die. I mean, they actually, because Pan Am would quite like the bay to put another 737 NG sim or an A320 sim, but they call it, because I think there was some kind of 80s movie called Hard to Kill, and they call the sim Hard to Kill 2. Because there's a few in Israel, there's a few military ones in South America, there's one in India. MIT have a flying test bed. It's an ex-Pan Am ship. So there are clients for it. And I think that's part of what I learned, is that, you know, there is a market for 707 training in 2019. Wow. I think if there was two sims in the world, they'd both go broke, but there's enough for one.
I have to ask you about it then. Sure. So Tim, what was that experience like? Who did you do your training with, and, you know, qualified 707 pilots?
Absolutely. Well, retired, you know, yeah. I mean, I think,
yeah.
Once you retire, maybe your medical's gone, but you could do sim instruction forever. And so it's just, as well as learning about the actual airplane, how can I describe this? You're really in there with you're at the coal face of aviation history, because I mean, the main instructor I worked with, a guy called Herman, he is well into his 80s and flew for a lot of funny airlines you've never heard of, mostly in the Americas, based in Haiti, based in Panama, and in some cases flying with airlines who had like two 707s and a DC-8, and he would fly both, which I think, you know, a lot of AOCs is not allowed. So you're the wealth of, and you're talking about 20,000-30,000 hours, 20,000 hours on type.
Wow.
The wealth of information and
some experience. Stories.
Absolutely, you know, eye-watering stories of where those guys learned their craft, and so that's me. That was what was thrilling about it. And at the Pan Am Flight Academy, is the last functioning business unit of the original Pan Am Airlines, Pan American World Airways, whatever it was, that went out of business in 1991. The flying academy, the flight academy in Miami stayed in business and is in business to this day. So it's in that sense, you're at the coalface, and they've got there's a big mosaic on the wall in the lobby that dates back to the 60s, and a big you know, big Pan Am 747 model that will have been kicking around there since the '70s. And a lot of the people who work there, you know, there's a little shop called Pan Am Aware. They're still selling off old amenity kits and golf balls and bits and pieces from the old days. And there must be a couple of warehouses full of it somewhere in Miami. Wow. And the Pan Am Aware shop is staffed by ex Pan Am flight attendants who are also in their 80s, you know.
Yeah.
And you're one guy who works at Pan Am Aware was on the famous last flight out of Saigon in 1975, which a feature film was made about.
Yeah.
And he was on it, you know. And so, again, I can only repeat the phrase, you're right at the coalface of aviation history by being there. So it's not just about learning about the 7.0 and the systems, which are super interesting, and, you know, the way it handles very heavy on the controls. I mean, you can tell, I mean, it was built for guys who had just come off B-17s and B-29s.
Yeah.
It's incredibly heavy. There's no hydraulics. There's no hydraulic assistance on the flying controls except on the rudder boost, and you can fly it without that.
Wow.
So, you know, that's some of the interesting stuff you learn when you're in the sim, but it's also when you're at the water cooler, you know, that's a whole nother education.
Okay, well, before I ask you about some of your other books, let's wrap up the 707. I just want to read one line from the book. You say, more than any other airliner, the 707 created the template for what a jet transport should be. When you look back on its service, what do you think the legacy of the 707 is?
Well, I think we're living it. I mean, it's. I think that you see this, the legacy of the 707 in every aspect of life. I mean, whether it's the incredibly diverse multicultural communities that we all live in, of course, people have been moving between continents by sea for centuries, but that the age of global mass transit really started with the 707. Even more so than with, I mean, the 747, I suppose, definitely gets a, you know, honorable mention in dispatches for, you know, opening the world up to global mass transit. But I mean, I call it the physical internet. I don't know why people don't understand this concept more readily.
Yeah.
Air transport is the physical internet. The actual internet, you know, you can send data and, you know, as attachments or whatever. But with the physical internet, you know, you've got portals or airports, if you prefer, where you can put people and goods in, and they pop out the other end only a few hours later, almost instantly. If you're flying west, it's almost instant. When you take off the time difference, it's almost an instant, you know. And that goes to the 707. So it's not just sort of aerospace, where you can say, well, of course, the 737NG has a lot of commonality with the 707, you know, with the panel and the controls and various, you know, the shape of the yoke and the cross section of the fuselage. But I think in a much wider sense, the fact that we eat fruit out of season and think that's normal, you know, and have goods air freighted from place to place overnight. The fact that it's possible for us to visit friends and family in other countries, that we can explore other countries on holiday instead of going to, I mean, you know, I Margate is fantastic, the Garden of England, etc. But with jet travel, you know, I know back streets in Japan or you know, New York or whatever, and
yeah.
That's the legacy.
Right. Well, let's park the 707 there. Just before we sign off, I just wanted to get a flavour for some of the other books that you've been involved in writing.
Sure.
I wasn't aware until I read this book about some of the other books. Tell us about some of the books that you've been involved in and covered, because I'm going to ask you some questions about the planes.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, my first book was the story of the Flying Tiger Line DC-8 fleet, and that book, which turned into a coffee table book, came out of the crowdfunding project. That was very well received. Especially by ex-Flying Tigers themselves.
Yeah.
Who are a pretty big community. Flying Tigers was a big and important airline. And indeed, it was what made FedEx a global carrier. FedEx bought Flying Tigers in 1989 And that was what turned FedEx from a US only overnight shipping company to a global operation. So the Tigers guys really liked that book, and so that led to the sequel Tiger 747, which is tells the story of all of the 747s that flew with Flying Tigers, and even a third volume, which is just pilot anecdotes, or not pilot, the memories of all of the airlines people. Me and my sometime co-author Guy Van Herbruggen, who made a big contribution of photos to the 707 manual. Guy and I wrote a big history of the MD-11.
Oh, there's an aircraft I like.
Yeah, it's an aircraft. Well, you know what? It's what's interesting when it comes to telling these stories. I think that aircraft which are unsuccessful or controversial, I think make for much better subjects than successful airplanes. I mean, it's not a golden rule, of course, because the 7.0 was a very successful type, but and also makes a good read. But the MD-11 was not successful. It wasn't successful from an engineering point of view, and it certainly wasn't successful from a commercial point of view, which makes for a fantastic read, you know.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to reading those books, and we'll maybe put some links in the show notes that go out with the program for people who want to look those up. Okay, Charles, let's leave it there. Where can we find out about you on the internet? Are you on social media, or are there any good websites we can catch up with you on?
Well, theairlineboutique.com is where I sell my books. Of the six books I've written, four of them are self-published. So the Airline Boutique is the main outlet for those. But those books are in the shops and on Amazon, etc. I'm on Facebook. You just find me under my name. If there's more than one Charles Kennedy, I'm the guy holding up a Pan Am Zippo. And I'm on Instagram as CharlieBoy747.
Right, okay. Well, I tell you what, we'll get those links off of you and we'll put those in the show notes as well. It's been fascinating, Charles. I really enjoyed the book, and I've really enjoyed learning a bit more about the 707 today.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on your podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation, so thank you so much.
Well, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and his team at the Aviation Historian for helping us to promote the programme. You can find Extended on all popular podcast players and, of course, on iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced, of course, with a Creative Commons licence. You can find me on social media on Twitter at Nascot Hornet. I'll be around on our Facebook page, on the Extended Facebook page, and, of course, at the Aviation and Aerospace Podcast Group on Facebook. So that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Charles.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.